Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm great. We're back at it.
We are back at it. I apologize in advance. Like, the children are running around and there's going to be some inevitable interjections, I should say.
Hey, that is beautiful. That is life. And we'll get through it.
Well, my apologies in advance to the technical editing staff on that front.
That's fair. I'll do the best I can. I'm not a highly paid technical expert. I want to share a case.
Yeah, let's do it. It's been a while since we've done cases.
Yeah. So it's an interesting case of a young woman who came in with hand pain, really centered over her third MCP joint after a minor trauma 6 months ago that led to a non-displaced metacarpal fracture. And so I got x-rays and she had avascular necrosis of the metacarpal head, which is not common. And I've seen a handful of times in my practice, but really, really interesting.
How often, what was the thing that led you to get the films at this point? Because sometimes, you know, if you have a metacarpal fracture, you assume everything's healed. What drove you to get the films at that point? Because honestly, I will say that I try to be pretty prudent and judicious about when I get films, for a few reasons, one of which being radiation exposure, cost, and clinic flow.
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, I didn't treat her initially, not that anything would have been different. And she had swelling at the joint level. And so, you know, the question, you know, at least in St. Louis, it's pretty uncommon that one can obtain an MRI if that's what would have been best for this patient without having x-rays. And so insurance companies push us to getting x-rays, but I have your philosophy. I don't want to get an x-ray unless I really have a strong reason to do so. But in this case, I did, which demonstrated the AVN.
Now, was this a fluoro in the office or was this an actual formal radiograph?
So here's how I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but I obtain plain radiographs rather than the far easier, far faster, far less expensive C-arm radiograph option, which we have in our office. But I obtain plain radiographs when I need definition, so some carpal abnormalities, when, you know, the precision of a plain radiograph will offer something, better assessment of healing or alignment or whatever. Or if I'm just not certain what's going on, sometimes I think it can be helpful. But C-arms are beautiful, and the ability to position for a C-arm is remarkable.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. There are some specific conditions in which I will always get formal radiographs. But then also from a documentation perspective, especially as insurers now are actually requiring, some of them, which is crazy, are requiring actual images to be sent to their office for review prior to authorizing certain procedures. Now, that hasn't really hit the hand surgery realm yet, but they are doing that for spine and for hip and knee arthroplasty. There's one particular insurer that requires images to be sent. Now, on the other end, you're like, who the heck is reviewing that? But, you know, it's a reality coming. So I usually will use plain radiographs for something for scaphoid fractures or suspected scaphoid fractures for, I'll get it for SL because there's a nice SL series that we have here. And then I think in this particular condition, I will admit I probably would have just gotten fluoroscan images, but hindsight's 2020, so probably would have gone with the plain radiographs. That's what you're telling me the condition is.
Well, and the beauty of a C-arm is so quick and so easy, and you can always order a radiograph after. So got the radiograph, knew the diagnosis. Trivia question for you, Dr. D. Do you know who gets the credit for, even though it may not be totally accurate, and what is the eponym around metacarpal head AVN? I know you're a smart guy, but you don't dabble in sports too much.
You know, Chuck, I don't know, but some friend, some angel left something in the chat for me.
I set you up for success.
I
know.
I couldn't do it, man. I couldn't do it. You know, I remember when we did an episode of Firsthand, one of the last ones, it was with I won't say who, but there was an episode that revolved around the elbow in which the guest started pimping me and my co-host. And it was the worst experience I've had in recent memory. And it made me recall all the times where I was on the receiving end of this line of questioning, and gave me a little empathy for now that I'm on the delivering end of questions.
For sure. But
Dieterich disease. Is it Dieterich? Dieterich? I don't know.
I thought it was Dieterich disease, but it's not. It is Dieterich disease, which is totally irrelevant. I think most of us have gotten away from pimping on eponyms, but there is some interest. So, not to belabor this case, but lengthy discussion with the family after the MRI confirmed exactly what we thought, and we proceeded with a MCP arthroscopy. Now, I wasn't certain that would be a sufficient treatment, but sometimes I've been surprised. And so we did a joint debridement. Large hole in the metacarpal head. This was not a situation where we thought that microfracture debridement could really lead to healing, and indeed it did not. And so patient comes back 6 months later still with discomfort, and we had to make a bigger decision.
What are the even options at that point? I mean, I think the MCP arthroscopy is an interesting one, and certainly where, if that's, you know, in your skill set, certainly worth offering. That's not probably where I would have gone. Honestly, I would have referred to you, but you know, what are your other options beyond that now?
Yeah, I don't think they're good. So, you know, you have a young patient. In this case, she was around 15, 14, but pretty close to skeletal maturity, if not at skeletal maturity for the metacarpal itself. So, you know, an adult, you can think about fusion. You can think about arthroplasty. I guess you could think about a resurfacing arthroplasty, but really the only thing I knew to do at this point was an OATS. And I've done it a couple of times before with good but not perfect success, and thought it would be a good option here. And that's indeed what we did. The interesting, I think the whole thing was interesting.
Hold on, before you go on, how big is the lesion? And how, you know, we talk about, you know, all of my knowledge of Dieterich disease, how big are these lesions typically? Are they the entirety of the metacarpal head, or are they a portion of the cartilage? Where does it tend to affect?
Yeah, my experience has been that they are always large. This one was 10 millimeters, pretty circular. And there was a rim, a radial, ulnar, and volar rim, which was intact. The dorsal was gone. And so it was the large, it was 75-80% of the metacarpal head. Remarkable. And so again, options are lousy. And I gave the family an option. An autograft or an allograft OATS plug. And I think wisely they chose allograft because she was a runner and she was a three-sport athlete. And there was some concern about harvesting an OATS plug from the knee. Now, I think that's, you know, those surgeries do really well. I have another one of them this week. But I was happy to do an allograft, and it makes for a really efficient surgery.
Now, are you ordering a metacarpal head when you're requesting your allograft, or are you, I don't know what surface you would take from that matches that contour, and if you can get that specific when you are requesting an allograft specimen?
Yeah, so what's interesting is one of the companies, and I might as well say it, I don't have a relationship with them, is Arthrex. They actually offer allograft plugs like you would take from the knee. And so it is just a plug of, and you specify the size, and they provide the plug, and you plug it in. And so it's not like you're requesting, and I am in the process of requesting a capitellum because I have a massive capitella lesion. This is different. This is literally just a plug of cartilage and bone.
Does the curvature and the contour of it matter? And do you get a selection of things you can use, and you can mix it or, you know, shave it down, that kind of thing?
You don't. Your control is around the way you drill your hole. So basically you drill a hole into the lesion to allow it to accept the slightly larger plug, and then you press fit the plug. So the way you drill your plug can help. And then you have a little bit of an ability to, the cartilage is pretty thick. You have a little bit of an ability to contour the cartilage. In this case, it worked out really well. The fit was great and the alignment was good. It's not perfect. It's not exactly the same as a metacarpal head, but we had a smooth arc of motion and patient did great. So really interesting to me.
And is that the fixation is all press fit, or is there any additional fixation?
All press fit.
Really interesting, cool case. Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Well, I feel like if I ever give in the approaching holiday season with a sports case, I have to pay the price. And so my price is I had to agree to a 3-part nerve series. My God.
Yes, you did. But it's a nerve series that everybody, and I believe it's a nerve series you published on, Mr. Workman. But let's talk a little bit about our friends first before we jump in and give it away. So The Upper Hand is sponsored by PracticeLink.com, the most widely used physician job search and career advancement resource.
Becoming a physician is hard, but finding the right job doesn't have to be. Join PracticeLink for free today at www.practicelink.com. Visit our friends. They have a huge wealth of practice information, not only helping you find a job, but just the resources they have on the website. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I think checking out the website will at least give you a sense of what questions you should be asking as you look for positions, you know. So, because, you know, whoever's listening may be looking as broadly as a private practice versus looking at something like an academics, but at least asking the questions and seeing what's out there will certainly help you.
Absolutely. All right. There's a drum roll going on in my house. Tell us about our nerve series. What are we going to do?
Well, yeah, I've been seeing patients, you know, I've seen a lot of radial nerve palsy patients at various time points on the spectrum, whether it's somebody who's early on and trying to figure out whether this, you know, getting a diagnosis and trying to figure out whether to, you know, go with watchful waiting, surgical indications, that kind of thing. And then, you know, trying to figure out then if you're going to surgery, what kind of surgery to do. And then the technical details. So I think it'd be good to at least talk today about maybe the condition, indications, and then potentially during future episodes to talk about, you know, technical aspects of surgery. Because I know that you've done a lot of tendon transfers in your years and written a lot about tendon transfers. One of the chapters I read and refer my trainees to is written by you about tendon transfers for radial nerves. So and then we could talk about the nerve stuff at some point when you are open to talking about that.
No, I love it. I obviously I'm a bit old school and I do believe in tendon transfers for many conditions. And in my pediatric population, especially with spastic disorders like CP, I do that regularly. But yeah, I think it's great. So we'll talk broadly to start and then maybe we'll have an episode 2 and 3 on tendon and nerve transfers respectively. I think it'd be a great way to start winding down 2022.
So let's talk about a case, for example. So how do you think about the patient with a closed humeral shaft palsy who, you know, say they were not treated surgically, they're noted to, for the humeral shaft, but they're noted to have a radial nerve palsy during their ER evaluation, and they're referred to you about a month out from their injury, and they have a low radial nerve palsy, triceps is intact, but they've got absent sensation in the superficial radial nerve distribution, and they've got a wrist drop and their MP joints are down.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, a classic presentation. You know, there always is talk about whether it was the nerve palsy present on arrival to the ED, if the humerus was reduced, that it then become identifiable. I guess in this case, patient comes to the ED, humerus fracture, radial nerve palsy. Let's just say the patient was treated in a coaptation splint or whatever. In my experience and my personal practice is to follow that patient and give the nerve time to declare itself and give us time to potentially obtain a nerve study. How do you think about it?
I think that, you know, mechanism matters a lot. So if it's the kind of standing level fall, I don't get as excited as if it was a ballistic or sharp injury. And that does change how I think about the workup. Ultrasound has helped us a lot, I think, as we think about, you know, is the nerve in one piece or two pieces, to put it very plainly. So if there is a ballistic component to it, or there's a sharp component, or there's been surgery involved, and we don't know whether the nerve is structurally intact, the ultrasound helps early on with answering that particular question, because otherwise you're waiting at least 3 or 4 weeks to get a nerve study, if you choose to get one even that early, before you can see any signs of denervation, because Wallerian degeneration hasn't kicked into the point where it can be picked up on the nerve study until about 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, I think that that so-called electrodiagnostic gap can be filled in pretty early with an ultrasound if you have concerns about continuity of the nerve. Now, with the closed standing level fall type mechanism, I think it's truly very hard to think about whether that the nerve could be in two pieces. So I'm less likely to act early on that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And that seems like that's the situation we were at least starting with. So fracture from a fall, we would assume it is a neuropraxia and will recover. In this very specific case, probably don't do an early ultrasound. If the patient does not demonstrate clear recovery at 6 weeks, and they might start showing some signs, do you get your nerve study at 6 weeks?
Well, I mean, ideally it's, you see him at the 6 week mark and then you get the study at 6 weeks. But in reality, especially at this time of the year, I'm probably thinking ahead and scheduling them for some kind of nerve study. The 6 week study for me is a luxury. I like it because it gives me a baseline. It gets me something to work from going forward. Do I truly need it? No. A lot of our decision is going to hinge on the 3 month mark. So in practicality, if this patient gets to me at 6 weeks, I'll examine them, get a baseline, and then set them up for a follow-up exam and a nerve study at the 3 month mark, and a nerve study before I see them, just so I can talk to them about the results of the study and re-examine them.
Do you, again, taking this very simplistic case, do you have to have a nerve study, or can you examine them at 3 months? And if they demonstrate radial wrist extensor improvement, or maybe some, finger extension improvement, do you still feel you need a nerve study, or is it just for those cases that are completely uncertain?
No, I mean, I think examining them again at the 3 month mark is absolutely helpful. And if you have the opportunity to do that, where you could quickly get the study that you want shortly thereafter, it's not going to create more issues with patients traveling in and, having to come back in for another exam, and, you don't have any issues with patient follow-up, then yeah, great. Do a repeat exam at 3 months and then determine whether you need to study. There are a lot of folks that will, if your baseline and your default is to treat these patients non-operatively, I think you probably will be more apt to slow down on the nerve studies and, give it a lot more time. I admit that my bias is that, I'm probably more apt to discuss surgical intervention just because of the patients that I've seen here. And then the fact that if you wait, and it doesn't get better, and you're in that 10 to 20% of, quote, neuropraxias, which by that point have declared themselves to not be neuropraxias, is it too late if you're at the 9 month mark? I mean, that's the data that was shown by Omer with all of the ballistic injuries from the wartime experiences. And in the mid 20th century was that, yes, a lot of them will get better. The problem is that if they don't get better, then you are stuck with, not a very narrow, but you have a definable set of options that do not involve nerve reconstruction, mainly tendon transfers.
Okay. For those of us who aren't masters of our nerve study domains, what might you see at 3 months or 4 months, which would say to you, waiting no longer makes sense? And obviously this is more than just reading the interpretation of the nerve study.
Well, so I'm going to assume that you've got, at 3 months, you still have absence of wrist extension and absence of thumb extension and absence of MP extension of the digits. So if that's the case, and then you could even say if you're able to discern whether brachioradialis is present or not, so if that's the case, on my nerve study, what I'm looking for is whether there are any motor unit potentials or recruitment with attempted wrist extension and attempted finger extension. I don't really trust the single motor unit, but if there's more than that, then I think there's a chance it could get better. And that's where I think that, the role of serial exams comes in, not necessarily serial EMGs, but, if there are a few motor units and the recruitment pattern is reasonable in terms of how it's listed on the table, then I think you may give it a chance to see if it gets better. You could look at things like CMAP amplitudes. I think they're a little less reliable for in this particular case, but they can be useful. And then you can look at the sensory studies for the superficial radial nerve. But again, a lot of what you do is ultimately going to hinge on the EMG of the affected muscles, specifically the wrist extensors and the EDC.
Does your interpretation of a nerve study differ in the situation of a ballistic injury or an open injury? Or is that more where you bring in the ultrasound? Or is the nerve study findings, or those findings and the importance of those findings similar no matter the type of trauma?
It matters a little bit, the type of trauma, because sometimes, if there's a muscle injury, the ability to the ability to recruit and have a normal pattern is going to be different. So for example, I had a patient who I treated when I was on ortho trauma call, who had a crush injury to the forearm with a both bone forearm fracture, an AIN palsy, and then a musculotendinous injury to the EDC. So the plated the both bone forearm fracture, repaired the musculotendinous injury to the EDC, and have been following the AIN. And we're not, you know, we obtained nerve studies for the AIN. And, you know, if we were to obtain a nerve study for that, for the EDC, not that we would get it in this particular case, but that would show an abnormal recruitment pattern, not because of the nerve component to it, but because of the muscle involvement. So I think, you know, taking into account the totality of the injury is important. But, you know, in this particular case scenario that we gave, I don't think it matters.
So let's talk about timing. So give me a list, if you can, of indications for early intervention. And some of this is going to be self-evident. Maybe all of it will be self-evident, but let's just keep it basic. In which situations do you intervene with nerve exploration early?
A sharp laceration or a traumatic wound in the area where the radial nerve is coursing, you know, basically starting at, you know, the so-called spiral groove and then distally to the level of the elbow, and then at the radial tunnel. So if you know there's a wound in that area and you've got a palsy, I think it's very reasonable to consider exploration. Now, an area of controversy is for patients who have had surgery on their humerus and the nerve was not directly exposed, and there's a palsy after surgery. Whether it was present before or after surgery is always questionable. But I think exploration of the nerve there is, I think it's helpful. Although I probably will use the ultrasound because we have it to answer the question about whether the nerve is in one or two pieces. Even if the nerve is one piece, it can be scarred down to the plate, which we've also seen, or it can be tickled by a screw, which we've seen. And that's something that I think has a poor prognosis. There are some parts of the world, for example, in the UK, where they have very low threshold and even have guidelines saying that they should explore any of the post-surgical nerve palsies. I don't think we've gotten there, but I have a lower threshold to explore and get the information because I think that adds to the diagnosis.
I love that. That's very helpful. And are there any other patient factors that push you towards an earlier surgery aside from coexisting injury, like you mentioned, where you're going to have a hard time with a nerve study, comorbidities, anything else, or is it pretty much as straightforward as you have outlined?
Well, it's never as straightforward as that. I think that there are some patients who have a little more, that want a little more information, and their personality is such where they want to know what's going on. So I think that's an earlier indication for exploration.
Perfect. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And then ultimately, indications for a late exploration get back to ultrasound in combination with nerve study findings suggesting that it's more, the nerve injury is more than a neuropraxia.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as we discuss in our next episode about this, I think the timing matters. I think it's whether we go at 3 months versus 6 months versus 9 months also depends on the menu of options you can give patients. If you are less likely to offer something like a nerve transfer because you don't have experience with it, that's okay. And then I think you're able to slow down your discussion. And then even, you know, if you're willing to offer something like exploration and grafting at the site of the injury, plus minus nerve transfers, that also changes your timing consideration. So I don't want to leave people with a cliffhanger, but we probably should because my family's about to erupt.
And that is our life stage difference. I'm sitting quietly in my basement so I don't wake up my family. You are living the family life right now.
I've got Legos crawling on me, and I've got my son coming in wanting to show me his hockey cards.
Well, last question in all seriousness is, if you classify median, radial, and ulnar nerves as most amenable to nerve grafting with good recovery, where does the radial nerve fit in that? Radial nerve seems to do well with nerve grafting. This is a teaser for our next episode. What's your thought on those three nerves comparatively?
I agree. And I think it's largely because of distance to target, but I think the radial nerve does have the best chance. And, you know, one of the people that was kind enough to have me as a visitor, Jaime Bertelli, has published on that particular scenario with radial nerve grafting. So I think the radial nerve is the best one.
Perfect. All right. With that, We will call it an episode, and we look forward to episodes 2 and 3 on radial nerve treatment. And we'll discuss a little more on timing and how we get into the specific treatment. So Chris, you have your work cut out for you today. Enjoy it.
Yes, the D family house is officially awake. but we could also potentially have a part 4. We can invite Macy to come on and talk about the therapy parts of it. So there we go. That might bring us to a close for 2022.
I love it. Let's do it.
An early Hanukkah and Christmas for all.
All right.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.